Hello, and welcome to the On SOA podcast series. In this special set of podcasts, SOA journalist Joe McKendrick interviews the authors and contributors behind the book, SOA Design Patterns, the newest title in the Prentice Hall Service-Oriented Computing series from Thomas Earle. You can learn more about this book and download sample chapters at soapatterns.com. Also, while listening to this podcast, you can look up any design patterns being discussed at soapatterns.org, a community site dedicated to the ongoing development and expansion of the SOA Patterns catalog. For more information about other series titles, be sure to visit soabooks.com. Now, here's Joe McKendrick.
Hello, this is Joe McKendrick, independent analyst and author of the ZDNet Service-Oriented Architecture blog site, as well as the eBizQ SOA in Action blog. And I'm here with Thomas Earle, author of SOA Design Patterns, published by Prentice Hall. Thomas is also a prolific author of a number of books and is also the founder of SOAschool.com, which provides the internationally recognized SOA certified professional program. Welcome, Thomas.
Thanks, Joe.
In this podcast, we're going to be discussing an important set of patterns Thomas and his colleagues in the SOAPatterns.org community have identified, and that's data-related patterns. In my observations of what's been taking place within the service-oriented architecture space in recent years, there's been a lot of discussion, and only lately, though, have there been actual efforts or initiatives to address some of the data management or data issues that are part of a very important part of service-oriented architecture. Thomas, can you tell us about the data-related patterns that you have identified within the book and how they fit into the success of SOA?
I'm sure. The data-related patterns cover a number of different topics and topic areas. It's a common part of just about any service-related design issue that you have to deal with. There's a few that come to mind which are quite interesting in relation to SOA specifically. There are, of course, some security-related ones like data origin authentication, data confidentiality, but I know we're going to talk about those separately with Jason Hogg from Microsoft when we have a chance to chat with him. But we have patterns that have to do with the importance of data that needs to be standardized on a fundamental level in order to guarantee baseline interoperability across services. And that is within a given inventory boundary. That's where we are always in pursuit of that. And that's where the focal point really is on fundamental patterns like canonical schema, which establishes a data model for each primary business document that is then shared among services, that is part of the service contracts when they're published, and then shared among services within a given service inventory boundary. And incidentally, it's a pattern that is different from the canonical data model pattern that was documented in Hope and Wolf's enterprise integration patterns. There are some differences there, and that's explained on the SOA pattern side. I won't get into that. But with that in mind, with that that goal of establishing a canonical data model for primary business documents, we then have various types of patterns that support that. One interesting one is called schema centralization, which supports canonical schema in a manner in that it allows us to actually establish an independent data architecture that is still supportive of the service architecture that is built upon it, but its independence allows the schemas, the standardized data models, to also be shared by areas of the enterprise environment that are not necessarily service-oriented or not based on services. They can still share those same schemas and benefit from the standardization, the primary benefit being the avoidance of integration layers like those that require transformation at runtime and so on. but still establish a solid data architecture in support of our services, our service layers, our service inventories. The other pattern I wanted to mention was contributed by a number of people from Oracle, including Clemens Uchik, and it's called Canonical Schema Bus, and it is actually taking the enterprise service bus concept a step toward supporting standardization in that it essentially establishes middleware with a lot of the message processing and transformation quality of service related extensions that are common to enterprise service bus products, but instead of facilitating and making it too convenient to connect disparate programs, so disparate services and service consumers, it actually enforces standardization by exposing canonical schemas only, and that carries over into canonical contracts eventually, and it puts the onus of compliance on service consumer programs and basically helps motivate project teams and all those involved with SOA initiatives to comply to standards pertaining to data models and related contract design standards in order to benefit from everything the middleware has to offer. So it's basically a platform that was created in response to a number of the organizational challenges that have traditionally come up when you try to establish and enforce design standards across different project teams. And if you don't have the authority to do it, or if there is still the freedom for project teams to ignore your standards and continue to do your own thing, that can undermine a lot of the strategic goals associated with service-oriented computing. And therefore, again, this was sort of in response to that. And I found it quite an interesting pattern.
It is interesting. And Thomas, it addresses a very critical area. I've seen surveys. Most organizations, most decent-sized organizations, have 3 to 4 different databases, data environments that they need to rationalize or better integrate if they're to move forward with enterprise SOA.
That's true. I mean, the legacy reality of what you face when you choose to adopt SOA, for most organizations, that won't go away as a result of the initial adoption phases. You can certainly try. And we've had clients, I can think of one client in particular, that did move ahead and build a parallel, purely service-oriented environment that they continue to develop and then switched over to in phases with the full intention of completely replacing their legacy environments over a period of a number of years. So that is something you can attempt, but many organizations don't have the support or the resources to do that. So legacy encapsulation is something that has to be dealt with, and having databases with redundant data and disparate data models is a very common reality. And when you introduce a service layer into that environment, the first consideration is to ensure that, at minimum, your endpoint layer, which we call the federated endpoint layer, which is a pattern in itself, the federated endpoint layer you establish, that on that level you achieve standardization. Each service can encapsulate and encompass whatever logic and resources it requires in order to carry out the functions and the capabilities associated within its functional scope, within that service's range of functionality that it provides. And that will often include a lot of legacy-related resources and systems. And as such, there are still integration and transformation-related processing that has to occur within the service boundaries. And that's still okay. That's still acceptable. We can still adopt SOA and build services in environments like that and work toward the strategic benefits of service-oriented computing, because what we're establishing is a set of endpoints that themselves are interoperable. They themselves are standardized on a data model level. They can share data, and they abstract, they hide all of their disparate implementation details from each other. And from a long-term evolutionary and governance perspective, that gives us the freedom to evolve, replace, upgrade, refactor those individual implementations as we see fit to do and as we're required to do by the business and as more resources may become available. We can do that while maintaining the relationships that we've established between services originally when we first created and then extended that endpoint layer. And that's where the standardization, the introduction of canonical schemas is so critical in the early stages. And again, everything I just mentioned is applied within a given service inventory boundary, and that's one of the primary areas of standardization that motivates organizations to have more than one service inventory so that for a different business domain or for a different segment of IT, they can apply their own data models and apply their own levels of standardization and establish their own federated endpoint layer and evolve that independently while collectively the enterprise is still working toward the grand scheme of SOA.
And, you know, years ago when I first started looking at what was happening with the rise of web services and SOA, I think there's a lot of discussion about what the ROI, return on investment, is for SOA and earlier on web services. And I think the most basic example and what I would consider maybe the first killer application for web services / SOA is simply the ability to reduce multiple data entry. One of the first instances I heard several years ago was a case where you had a company with multiple mainframes that store customer data, you know, up to eight mainframes with eight different versions of who their customer was, and they deployed a middleware layer to capture the process on each of these back-end mainframes and bring it forward in one screen to a data entry person. They no longer had to enter a customer name eight different times, in other words.
Right.
I mean, that's very simple. They're a very simple example of ROI, but it seems to pertain to what we're talking about here.
It does, yeah. I mean, there are different ways of measuring ROI within SOA environments. Many focus on the actual runtime reuse of services, but when you think of an example like what you just described, there is a definite, concrete return that you're gaining on an ongoing basis compared to how it was before. And even with services that we provide to different consumers and that are consume services from different providers, there's a whole set of metrics that have emerged around measuring ROI, which we often use when we do consulting and so on. But it's a really interesting area to get into, and it's good to know, as you said, that it goes beyond just the runtime instance or runtime reuse of services.
And is this something an SOA proponent with an organization? Is this something they can take to the data managers, the data stewards within their organization to better collaborate and achieve better alignment between what the folks in the data, managing the databases and the data are doing, and the folks that are working on the middleware and SOA are doing?
I think so. I think it would be a really wise thing to do to get all those different groups together, especially when first defining your canonical data architecture, when basically establishing, okay, this is an invoice document. How should it be represented on a service contract level? Not redesigning all the databases that have been around now for the past 20 years, not trying to normalize and optimize everything on a implementation level, but as a starting point, focusing on this federated endpoint layer of service contracts and saying, okay, how should an invoice be represented? How do we want it to be shared across services that, are primarily focused on invoice-related processing or only peripherally focused on it. Maybe it's doing some reporting, and invoices may or may not be part of reports for certain types of requests and so on. So the point being that establishing those foundational canonical data models, canonical schemas, when they are first, when you first define that layer, and having the support of your data analysts and those that manage that, the data custodians and those that own the data, I think is really the best situation to proceed with. And of course, in order for that to be successful, those different groups will need to support the SOA initiative as a whole, and be open to changing how they've defined data in the past, because now you might need to reach some sort of level of agreement between different data custodians who have traditionally been isolated from each other. And not to go back to this again, but when a consensus, when an agreement cannot be reached, when the differences are irreconcilable and they cannot proceed to actually come to a canonical model, then that may make the case for actually establishing domain boundaries around service inventories. That's sometimes the point at which domain inventories get explored, when agreement cannot be established on the data model level.
Okay, great. I'm here with Thomas Earle. Thank you, Thomas, for exploring the data-related patterns you've identified in your book, SOA Design Patterns. Again, this is Joe McKendrick, and we thank you for joining us, and we invite you to join us in the next podcast of this series, in which Thomas will detail service contract-related patterns as part of SOA. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this installment of the On SOA podcast series. To learn more about the Prentice Hall Service-Oriented Computing series from Thomas Earle, please visit soabooks.com. Also, all the books in the series are available online at Safari Books Online, which can be accessed at safari.informit.com.